step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello everyone and welcome to Q&A. I'm Jay Nordlinger, and this episode is brought to you by Tommy John for inspired underwear, yes, and X-Chair for inspired sitting. I'll have more to say about these inspirational sponsors later in the show. Our guest is Daniel Asia, a composer and educator, even an activist in a way. He teaches at the University of Arizona. He also heads the American Culture and Ideas Initiative. He has written pieces of many types, symphonies, operas, oratorios, chamber music, the works. He has also written articles, and you can find some of them in a recent collection, Observations on Music, Culture, and Politics. He's an old comrade of mine, and I'm pleased to welcome Daniel Asia. Hey, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Dan, on this show, we sometimes start with names, and your name is Asia, and I wonder how you acquired it or how your family did. You're the only Asia, as opposed to Asian, I've ever known in my life.
It's a great question. So being Jewish, we assumed that somehow the name had been changed at Ellis Island, but in fact, we have traced the name back to the little town that my family came from, which is Kremenets in the Ukraine. And we even have pictures from the latter part of the 19th century with the name Asia on it. But you're right, I don't have many relatives. We think maybe the origination is from the Hebrew or Aramaic Asia, which means physician. Oh. But aside from that possibility, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, I was reading your bio at the U of A, and I assume you wrote it, and I want to read a sentence because it stood out to me. He is a unique and eclectic Jewish composer, conductor, educator, and writer, and everyone's talking about identity these days, and I just thought it was interesting, Jewish composer.
Well, I don't remember if you and I have spoken about this. I think maybe in passing.
Yeah.
So here's the question. If you open up an article about Leonard Bernstein or an article about Isaac Stern, it might say that they are an American conductor and an American violinist, respectively. And then if you read their biography, it will probably say that they are, in fact, of Russian origination. Now, that's where their families came from, right?
Which is nonsense.
Something to that effect. Exactly.
Nonsense.
And the problem, of course, with something like that is that for better or worse, certainly in most of larger Europe, Jews were certainly up until the emancipation in the early 1800s were a people separate and apart. They thought of themselves that way, and they were perceived as such by the populations in which they lived. They were rarely, at least for a long time, welcomed, which is to say they were sometimes welcomed, and then eventually they were not, usually for anti-Semitic reasons. So I have a problem with that kind of designation, and I've concluded, at least for Jewish composers in America, It's better to say, you know, we're Jewish, which is not to say that we're not American. Of course we are. It's just to say that I don't want people to suggest that my forebears were Ekta, which means real Ukrainians, right? We weren't. We ended up in the Ukraine because we were probably kicked out from someplace else a couple hundred years beforehand. So it's just a way of making things clear of who and what I am.
Dan, many years ago, I wrote an article in which I referred to, Eugene Ormandy, George Zell, Fritz Reiner, and George Schulte as Hungarian Jewish conductors. And I got several notes, emails saying, why did you have to drag religion or ethnicity into it? And I thought the answer would have been obvious, but obviously it wasn't because people were confused. At a very critical moment, most Hungarians didn't consider those men and men like them their fellow Hungarians. So why should they get credit for them now as Hungarian conductors? They didn't really welcome them as Hungarians before. Why should they get the reflected glory, if you will? And in my mind, that was obvious. And it would have been to you, but it wasn't to others.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. And the reason for that is both for a good reason, and I think probably a bad one. And that is, the good part is in America, Jews, I'm going to say that by and large, if not having been accepted as Jews, have at least been have not been discriminated tremendously such that Jews have not been able to proceed to have livelihoods and create communities and families in the United States. Which is to say that, yes, of course, America has discriminated against Jews during the course of its history, in the same way that it's discriminated against Catholics, against Irish, and against Italians. Has that affected us such that we have not been able to join into the larger sense of American culture and to proceed to live good and happy lives? It has not. So Americans wouldn't let us into their clubs. So what? We created our own nice clubs, just as Italians did.
You remember what Groucho Marx said. My daughter's only half Jewish. Can she play nine holes?
Exactly.
Can she go into the pool up to her knees?
Right. Yeah, he was a good one. So I think the point is you're absolutely correct. Also, we Americans, remember, have really very little sense of larger historical factors, which again, is just as you've said. So when was Hungary actually created? Then you have to ask, well, which Hungary was that? Was it the Hungary of the Austro-Hungarian Empire? Is it the Hungary after World War I, when Austria and Hungary become independent nations, carved out of various parts of Europe that included various minority populations within the larger country that was created, right? That's not something that we normally know. We just assume Hungary's always exist and Austria has always existed as it is today. So what you're pointing out is that, yeah, there are historical factors that come into play here in a very big way.
Well, Dan Asia, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in that great Jewish metropolis of Seattle, Washington.
Was that before the grunge scene?
Yes, it was just prior to the grunge scene. Jimi Hendrix was a compatriot, but by then Jimmy had already left town and had headed off, I think, for New York and London. He was a few years my senior. But Quincy Jones, by the way, grew up in Seattle.
Well, did you know Jimi Hendrix?
I did not. I wish I could say that I did.
How about Quincy?
I did not know Quincy. Quincy is, you know, now about 90 years old. Uh-huh. And I'm 68, so he was a whole generation prior to mine.
I think of Quincy Jones as perpetually 35.
I know. But my claim to fame is that I was in the same class as Paul Allen, and Bill Gates was 1 year behind me in high school.
Oh, man. You should have befriended them if you didn't.
I know. And that was one of the failings that I acknowledge to this day, made a mistake.
You're doing great regardless. And you went to college all the way across the continent.
I did. My very important professor, music professor in high school, is still my good friend, Peter Siebert, had gone to Amherst. And I was looking for colleges, and he said, you know, I don't think you'd like Amherst because you have this wild streak, but there's this new place that's starting up called Hampshire College, and you might look into it and see if it's of interest. I did, and I applied, and at that time, Hampshire College was the most difficult college in the United States to get into. It was in vogue because it had just started. And lo and behold, I didn't get in. I was on the waiting list. So until June, you're looking at someone who would have gone to Vassar College and helped integrate Vassar College with men. But instead of doing that, I got in off the waiting list. You know, I just wasn't that good. And I went to Hampshire College.
And then Yale.
And then from there, I went to Yale for a couple of years to where I studied both composition and conducting. It was a wonderful experience. I studied with Jacob Druckmann, who was one of my real mentors, and then a conductor named Arthur Weisberg. And Jacob at that point was the flavor of the month or the year, to say the least. I remember in the bicentennial, I think he must have gotten 3 or 4 commissions, and Jacob, not wanting to let anything get past him, I think took on 4 orchestral commissions in a year and a half, which is a pretty astounding feat. And Arthur, of course, ran his ensemble in New York and did all of those wonderful recordings with Nonesuch Records. Those are the records that I grew up on really as a college student. To learn a lot about the repertoire.
Well, why did you want to be a composer, or could you simply not help it?
Yeah.
Well, was it a choice or was it destiny?
That's, you know, you put it absolutely wonderfully. So when I went to Hampshire College,
well, let's face it, people don't like to hear this, but real composers or real writers or real artists never choose to be those things.
Well,
you are, you aren't.
That is.
You can't tell people this because it's insulting.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I can't choose to be on the PGA Tour.
Right. Right. When I got to Hampshire, I said, "Look, you know, here you are. You're at a wonderful, brand new liberal arts college. Why don't you explore the liberal arts and see if music, you know, can just be fun and a hobby and something you enjoy." And after 3 weeks, I was literally going crazy. I said, this is just impossible. And being that it was Hampshire College, I went to the music professor and said, I got to write music. I have to do music. That's all there is to it. And he said, come on aboard. His name was Randall McClellan. And from then on, I was on, quote, the music track at this peculiar place called Hampshire College, where there were courses, but there were no exams, and there was no methodology or curriculum for music, as it were. And I proceeded to study music there for 3 years, and 1 year I spent at the San Francisco Conservatory, what would have been my junior year, because I felt I was a little bit deficient in theory and solfege. Mm. And I studied both of those subjects. Plus, I went through every Haydn symphony that they had available in the library.
They didn't have all 104?
No, I don't think they did. They had a few holes in their collection.
That's okay. There's enough to go around.
But I bet I made it through about 80 of them. And I read, I think it's Mr. Landon, who wrote a big treatise.
Yeah. Robert Landon.
I don't know why I was into Haydn, but I thought, God, this is a great composer. And Haydn at that point, we're talking about the 70s. You hardly heard a Haydn symphony played at an orchestra concert. You know,
I bet those were the years when the recordings by Antal Doradi were coming out. I think all 104 were the Philharmonia Hungarica.
I think you're right.
Remember how cool that was?
I do. And then there's an American conductor whose first name is escaping me, but his name is Wolf. Do you know who I'm thinking of?
A more recent figure, you mean? Like Hugo Wolf? That's the composer.
Hugh Wolf, exactly. Hugh Wolf was
actually, I associate him with St. Paul. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he was
The man, the city.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
Well, sorry, just coughing a second. Dan, you told me once years ago about an experience, your experiences in Berlin and their impact on you. And before we go to our first break, would you tell our listeners what was important about being in Berlin?
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I went to study. I had a DAAD fellowship, which is the German equivalent of a Fulbright.
I was going to say, it sounded like some sort of disorder or like. Yeah. Like
oh, you're right.
As my grandmother.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Once said, everyone has initials these days.
That's right. That's right. Anyway, so I had hoped to go study with Georgi Ligeti in Hamburg, but he had a three-year waiting list. So I called my friend Earl Brown and said, Earl, I have to find a composer to go study with. They're gonna take this grant away. So he said, oh, you know, I've got a good friend, Isang Yuns in Berlin. I'll call Isang and I'm sure he'll be happy to take you on as a student. And that was the case. And that's what happened. So my wife and I packed up. We left New York and went and studied German for 4 months in a little town called Schwäbisch Hall. And then we went to Berlin. So when one goes to Berlin, you, of course, go through what was then East Germany. Again, which is now almost ancient history. Max, be quiet.
That's sorry, okay. A little music. Yeah.
I've got my dog here, right?
Named after Max Bruch?
I'm sorry?
Named after Max Bruch?
Yeah, no. I hadn't thought of that. No. So when you travel, therefore, to West Berlin, you go through East Berlin. And of course, every mile or less, there are guard towers and barbed wire and nobody around. I forget whether we drove or we did drive because we got stopped by the East German police and told we had to pay a fine because we were speeding. And of course, we had not been speeding. And what I found out later, of course, that's what they do to anybody with a Western license plate, because that's the way you got Western currency, or that's how they got Western currency. Anyway, I studied with Isan during the year and made friends with numerous folks in West Berlin. And among the things that they said was, you know, there's really no difference between the United States and the then Soviet Union. You're really just both superpowers. And I have to admit, I was astounded and somewhat taken aback. This was, of course, the year just after the Russians had invaded Afghanistan. And I had been to East Berlin. My wife worked for a U.S. military school, so it gave us access to East Berlin. And the differences, of course, were rather stark between the two. But most importantly was the fact that probably on a weekly, if not monthly basis, somebody would usually be shot and killed, an East German, trying to get their way into West Germany, into West Berlin. And I simply said to my friends, why is it that no West Berliners are trying to jump the wall to get into East Berlin? Why is it only the other way around? And of course, there was no response to that. And it was therefore at that time when I took a really hard look, I guess, at some of my political and cultural values or positions and said, gee, maybe there's certain things about America and its history and its values that I need to explore a little more greatly.
Wonderful. Let me tell you this, Dan. I remember Caspar Weinberger, when he was Secretary of Defense, pointing out Allied soldiers, NATO soldiers, and East German soldiers along the West German, East German border are facing the same way east. The East German soldiers were facing that way to keep people in. They weren't facing west out of fear of any invasion or anything. Mm-hmm. Fascinating fact.
Yes, exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking with Daniel Asia, the composer at the University of Arizona. I'm Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A. Back after this word from our sponsor, Tommy John. This Black Friday, celebrate softness season by stocking up on your favorite Tommy John underwear, loungewear, and pajamas. When you start your day wearing Tommy John, you're that much more comfortable, which helps a lot. Shop their Black Friday sale right now and give the gift of comfort to everyone on your list, including yourself, with Tommy John men's and women's loungewear. With over 16 million pairs sold, giving the gift of Tommy John underwear and loungewear has become a holiday tradition for families across the country. 98% of women and men love getting a gift from Tommy John. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. Now, underwear may be a slightly uncomfortable topic to talk about, but comfortable underwear is something that everyone can relate to. Can I get an amen? This holiday, make everyone in your family that much more comfortable with the gift of Tommy John loungewear, underwear, and bras. Plus, it's all backed by Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or it's free guarantee. During Tommy John's Black Friday sale, get 20% off site-wide at tommyjohn.com/QA. Get 20% off for a limited time only at tommyjohn.com/QA. Go right now to tommyjohn.com/QA. See site for details. Welcome back, everyone, to Q&A. I am Jay Nordlinger, speaking with an old friend and comrade of mine, the composer Daniel Asia, who has written the collection Observations on Music, Culture, and Politics. Dan, I'm around a lot of very bright, very well-educated young people. I've met them regularly over the years. They know about so much, these guys and gals, so much. And typically, they know squat, and I mean squat, about music. What the hell? I mean, you have, as I put it before, a front row seat. And when people arrive in college, do they know the names Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven? I'm not talking about Chopin and Grieg and, oh, I don't know, Prokofiev. I'm talking about Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. Do they know the names? Even vaguely?
The answer is sadly and unfortunately, no. We're living in a time, it seems to me, where culture, and then let me put in the adjective, which I think needs to be used, which is high, for high culture, has by and large been relegated to a tiny, tiny corner within our society. So the problem is not just, by the way, those kids who are so smart, and yes, they are smart.
Oh, no, it's not their fault. They haven't been exposed.
Exactly. So my generation, or our generation, I'll include the two of us right
now,
has let these kids down in a very significant way. While we may, and I'm going to again say only may, talk about matters of truth and goodness, those categories are not dealt with very much. We live in a rather superficial society where questions of religion, where you might also encounter those notions, but within the religious sphere or domain, the result is that our generation and now our children simply don't ask these questions or look at these areas of interest. They're not categories that they entertain and that they confront. And high culture is, unfortunately, the worst dealt with of all of these. It's as if beauty is no longer of interest to anybody, and what beauty actually means and how we view it. And by view, I mean also literally view, see it and hear it. So we have been so dominated by popular culture, both in terms of its imagery and its music, that there is almost no room for anything else. And look, even when you talk to somebody, a kid, and say, hey, you know, have you heard any really good music? And you mention the names that you just mentioned, they'll say, no, I've never heard of that. But man, you know, I listen to classical rock. You know, I've heard of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I've heard of Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you do one of two things. You throw up your hands and say, okay, it's finished. Or you say, how do I open up their ears and eyes to some of the greatest artifacts, let's use that word for right now, that human beings have ever created? And that means over the last 4,000 to 5,000 years with visual art, and the last 2,000 years or so of music, and probably about 500 or 600, I'm calculating roughly, of dance, for example, and say, you know, that there have been contributions in these areas before 50 years ago. And you might want to check some of them out.
Dan, I think you've pointed out that what's very important is that a young person, a very young person, grade school person, learn to play an instrument or learn to sing. Be in a choir or band or orchestra. And when I was growing up in my town, Ann Arbor, Michigan, maybe this was exceptional. Of course, when you're a kid, you think that the place you grew up in is normal. But you were required to learn an instrument. I think in fourth grade or fifth grade, you were required to take up an instrument. It wasn't an option. It wasn't an elective. You just did. And it was part of life, like gym and sports and math and reading and, you know, music. It was just unquestioned. It was part of life. It wasn't something special or apart. Is that kaput?
Yes. In a word, that is kaput. The arts, I don't know when this happened. It's an interesting question. I'd have to track it. But probably sometime in the 80s or 90s, it wouldn't have been in the 70s, because that's when I was finishing my high school, or maybe the late 60s, that somehow the arts as a participatory field and one also that you would study stopped, which is, again, it was sometime when money became a problem. And why money became a problem in terms of education, I don't know, because we were doing pretty well. Why is it that arts somehow became something that could be taken out of the curriculum as somehow being second in terms of what needed to be studied to everything else? And everything also obviously includes sports. Somehow it became considered as ancillary rather than somehow central to our experience of what it means to be human. And the popular became acceptable as a replacement to that. And I'm sure there are studies on all of this, and I should know this, but I don't right now. All I can say is that is certainly what happened, to the extent that now, if you have music education in schools, particularly given the state of our woke politics in curriculum, if you're in a Hispanic school system, for example, why would you need an orchestra when you should have something like a mariachi band, which represents the music of a large component of the students who are in your school? Why should you present something of the white patriarchal European culture rather than something that is of the local culture? And I think this has infected not just music, but of course the visual arts as well. Whereas before, yeah, you might have drawing and having people draw, but you will not have people play an instrument. You might have them listen to music, but it's probably the music of the last 50 years rather than of the tradition that we know and accept as being, quote, great, unquote. This also, I think, has to do with the leveling of the cultural milieu, which is to say that who could or should have the audacity to say that any music is better than any other music, or that any visual image is better than any other visual image, or for that matter, that any book is better than any other book. So
it's so weird. I mean, when we were growing up, we were told what is true, that music is something universal. It belongs to all mankind. It's not particular. Of course, there's folk music, including folk dances and so on, and there are folk influences in classical music. But music is universal and human, in some cases divine. Is the Bach B minor mass a white male German piece? No, it's for all mankind. And it was virtually written by God, I think. It just, you know, race and ethnicity and sex have invaded everything. It's so strange. And people always, some people prided themselves on the universality of music. You know, Leontine Price in her recitals all over the world took care to include spirituals at the end. And she sang German art songs and French art songs and Italian ones. And she promoted American composers, most of whom were her personal friends, Barber, Wiebe, Roram, others. She was a great Mozartian in opera, a great Straussian. And she was a Black girl from Laurel, Mississippi. That had nothing to do with it. Music belongs to all of us. I don't understand why that idea has been knocked down in life. It's so important. And it includes and embraces everyone, excludes no one. Music doesn't know whether it's white or Black or male or female or tall or short. Music is music. No?
I couldn't agree more with what you've just said. But certainly the politics of culture, and they are, if nothing else, they are that, says otherwise at this point. You and I grew up at a time when we assumed that all human understanding and all culture was available to all, that anyone could walk through the door of culture and gain its benefits. But, it's a but, it required an openness to do so and work. Simple as that. We now live in a time where the notion of multiculturalism has, in my view, run amok, such that, again, it wants to promote, I guess the word is equity. I think equity means that we try and promote the notion that everything is equal, or bring everybody or take everybody down to a place where some notion of equality is what carries the day.
In other words, Jay Nordlinger's ditties are as good as Bach's cantatas.
That's correct, because they
are bonkers.
Of course it is. But the notion, don't forget, is that your truth is as important as anybody else's truth. Mm-hmm. This goes along with the notion that any narrative is equally as important as any other narrative. Whether there are facts involved, that doesn't matter, or lies involved, doesn't matter. Whether it's, the point is that every individual, as opposed, look, you and I know that Bach and Beethoven and Mozart are the most fabulous composers who have ever existed. Where do we get that notion? Where does that come into play? Well, it has to do also with a historical sensibility that our forebears and those who studied and really delved into the music of many, many composers. Those are experts. Those are connoisseurs who said, by the way, life is short. You know, if you want to get to Telemann, that's great. But before you listen to Telemann, you might want to listen to Bach and Handel. Mm-hmm. You just might, only because they really
have. There's only so much time. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Exactly. There is only so much time. But that's not the way people think now. That's not.
It's terrific. Terrific. But Mozart and Beethoven first.
Exactly.
Time left over for Hummel. Great.
Exactly. Or Spohr.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. Composer. Sure.
But at least listen to these guys that lots of really great thinkers have said, they just went a little deeper. And as you said before, not only did they go deeper, but they went a little higher. You know, maybe there was inspiration by God. I mean, I actually hold to that notion that composers do have this direct connection to something other. But again, that's completely outside of any thinking that would be acceptable amongst my colleagues or in the larger culture.
Well, as I've said many times, Dan Asia, your students are very, very lucky to have you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A with Daniel Asia, the composer. He is the author of Observations on Music, Culture, and Politics. Back after this word from our sponsor, X-Chair. When you sit in an X-Chair, your body says, ah, so this is what an office chair can feel like. You actually look forward to sitting in your office when you have an X-Chair. Can your current office chair give you a massage while you're working? X-Chair can. Can your current office chair heat up or cool down? X-Chair can. It's all in the LMX massage and temperature regulation, exclusively designed and made for X-Chair. And once you feel the customized support of X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, your back may never be happy in any other chair again. High performance, quality engineering, extreme comfort. Look, even when you're not working, you may want to sit in your X-Chair just to get that feeling. I recommend that you try X-Chair for yourself, risk-free, for 30 days. Chances are, you'll never go back. This is what you do. Go to xchairqa.com. That's the letter X, chairqa.com. Or call 1-844-4-X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. XChairQA.com. Welcome back, everybody, to Q&A. I'm Jane Nordlinger speaking with Daniel Asia. Dan, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but many years ago, I was talking with Ned Roram, and he said this, and as usual, ladies and gentlemen, if you can hear sirens out my windows, well, that's New York, and it's an unseasonably warm day, so my windows are partly opened. Anyway, Roram said, the general public has no notion of what it is we composers do. Performers are more important than composers, a lot more important in the eyes of the world. We're a despised minority, he said. Actually, we're not even that, because we don't even exist. And to be despised, you have to exist. He went on to say that professional people know something of contemporary writers and artists, technologists, but composers, no. Have you found that true in your career?
Oh, sadly, but absolutely so.
How did this happen? Everyone knew who Igor Stravinsky was. And that was just, you know, in the middle of the century we were born in and grew up in. Everyone knew who Stravinsky was, and Shostakovich was, and the other big guys, and Darius Milhaud, and everyone knew who they were. Pierre Boulez.
Yeah. So here's, I'm going to even drive that point home more. A colleague of mine who I won't mention by name, only because I don't know if he would prefer I do so or don't, said, you know, in the Academy of Arts and Letters, which is made up of writers, poets, visual artists, I believe, composers, he said, my writer friends, they know nothing about what I do. They know nothing about composition. They might know something about the latest TV series on Netflix. If they're novelists, they might know something about novels. If they're poets, they might know something about poetry. He said, but they don't know anything about composers. They have no idea. They might follow jazz because that's kind of hip. And they might be interested in alternative rock. But they're completely befuddled by composition.
I suppose there, I can think of two composers today with a general reputation. John Williams and Philip Glass. I don't think I could name a third.
Well, you might include John Adams in that.
Okay.
But only perhaps.
Perhaps. Only perhaps. Yeah.
So that's an interest. Let's talk about that. So when I give exams, you've mentioned that I'm a professor. I sometimes ask my incoming doctoral students, both when they come in and when they go out, so who's the most influential composer of the 20th century? And this year I got the answer, John Williams, from one student. Because as you've just mentioned, he's probably one of the most visible composers. Now, I had to think about that. I have to admit, I was taken aback. Never occurred to me that somebody would consider John Williams to be the most influential composer. And I realized then what he was talking about. So John Williams has written music for some of the most seen, most witnessed movies of what, maybe the last 40, 50 years, something
like that. In history.
In history. Now, why would it never have occurred to me to consider John Williams a great composer? Because I can assure you, because I've been told this, John Williams doesn't consider himself a great composer. He knows that he does very well at writing music for commercial purposes, that he can do it very fast, and that he can allude to many other composers in his own music and borrow from many other composers very successfully. But he doesn't have that one thing that a great composer must have. And that is a truly individual voice, right? Something that expresses his or her soul. There's a comment that somebody just sent me very recently about Stravinsky, where somebody said, wrote to him and said, Stravinsky, your music has been very well received in Fantasia, in the movie Fantasia. It could be even given a greater hearing if you would allow so-and-so to orchestrate it. To which Stravinsky replied, very happy just with been received very well. Not interested in having somebody else orchestrate my music. Now, what was Stravinsky saying is, you know, part of being a composer is you write the music and you orchestrate the music. The sound of the music is yours. Well, look, John Williams' music doesn't sound like anybody other than a lot of Hollywood orchestrators who then orchestrate his music. It's a problem I have with some of Bernstein's early stuff that he gave to Hollywood orchestrators to do their work on. Now, Philip Glass is another interesting story. So Philip went out of his way to really become popular. I mean, Philip Glass in some way, and I mean this in no way to denigrate it, he's kind of Philip Glass Inc., right? I mean, he went out and he got media people, he got people to record his music, he recorded his own music, he promoted it, he went on Saturday Night Live with his band. He went out there to sell his music. Doesn't take away from his music, you can like it or not like it, mm-hmm. or like some of it or not like some of it. I guess the only point is, to get back to your earlier question, somehow, well, it's not somehow, we know exactly what happened. There was a break in the 60s or 50s and 60s when classical music in some way said to its audience, we don't really care if you listen to our music. That's the famous quote by Milton Babbitt.
And now, as he always says, he didn't write that headline.
Exactly. He didn't write that headline.
The editor at High Fidelity did. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who cares if they listen? Yeah.
Who cares if they listen? Now, yeah. Of course, every composer does care if you listen. Yeah. We don't write just for ourselves.
No.
And I think the point is, again, I'll quote my unnamed friend who's wonderful. He said, look, there are many houses or many rooms, rather, in the house of classical music from the beginning of the 20th century onward, mm-hmm. which is to say, again, where you can say in the classical period, who are the great composers? Well, it's Mozart and Haydn and then others. Mm-hmm. Who is it in the, did I say Baroque period? In the Baroque period, it's Bach and Handel. In the classical period, it's Mozart and Haydn, and then Beethoven, in the Romantic period, etc. You know, there are two or three in every period. Music is not a forgiving business or art form. Let me tell you, it's not easy. And then you get to the 20th century and things open up a bit. You get Bartok, you get Stravinsky, you get Rimsky-Korsakov, you get Prokofiev, you get Shostakovich, you get Copland, you have Ives. And then in the latter half of the 20th century, it grows exponentially. Why? Because the world grows exponentially. You don't just have Western Europe. You got Western Europe, Eastern Europe. You got the United States contributing. And there may not be a great composer who comes out of the latter part of the 20th century after Stravinsky. Maybe they're very good ones, but maybe none that are going to be at the very top. I don't know. We'll have to see how what history tells us about this period. But what I do know is what happens to me if people tell me, I hate contemporary music. I say, really? Have you ever heard of the music of Stephen Albert? Have you ever heard of the music of Schwantner? Have you ever heard of the music of Dan Asia? Have you ever heard of the music of Robert Beezer? And they say, no, who are they? I say, well, they're extraordinarily good composers whose music, if you listen to it, you would love it. You'd love it. So where are you? Why aren't you seeking this out? And the other problem here is that people feel they can somehow participate in the culture, that they can be engaged human beings with their culture without exploring, even in the most superficial way, the composers of the recent past and their own time.
Well, Dan, I was going to ask you here at the end, who are some of your favorite composers of today? And you said Stephen Albert, Robert Beezer. Give me more names.
Oh, Bernard Rands. Christopher Rouse, Joan Tower, Ellen Tafes Willich, Gusta Reed Thomas, Shulamit Ron,
and others, you can say.
Yeah.
They're not meaning to exclude anyone.
Yeah, Robert Maggio. I mean, David Zubé. There's just a, there are so many, it's hard for me to exclude.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Bill Buckley
and many others. And many others. So yeah. I'll just say and many others. Yeah.
Bill Buckley often quoted in Latin what I will say in English, because I can't remember the Latin. To include some is to exclude others. And this is what he'd say when he started to thank people or explain why he wasn't going to thank people. And it just occurred to me to say that some in our audience might be amused by this, but I think John Williams is wonderful, and I know you do too. And I think one of his best works is the music he wrote for NBC News, which he called The Mission. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if NBC News still uses the Admiral Marsh Network News in decades, but yes. Tell me, forgetting composers of today, or include them if you want, who are your composers all time? Of course, we would say all of them. We need them all, from Gregorian chant until this morning. But who are some of the composers closest to your heart?
That's really pretty easy, and I'm gonna quote Joan Tower. I'll just agree with her and say, it's hard to imagine the course of history of music and contemporary music, I guess in particular, without Beethoven. So that's you've mentioned a few of the greatest: Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, and then, so who do you exclude? Then Schubert, mm-hmm. Chopin.
All of them. They're a family. They all relate to one another. It's like people say to me, sometimes there's this discussion, who's your favorite founder, American founder, founding father? Mm-hmm. And among my smart friends, there are fierce debates between the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. I don't really care. I love and need them all as a kind of family with their various strands. It's even hard for me to differentiate among them. To me, they are a group, and I need them all, you know, whatever their angle. And I feel the same about the top composers.
And I couldn't agree more. Remember, in the time of Brahms and Wagner, either you were a Wagnerite, right, or you were a Brahmsian. But you weren't both. You weren't both.
So weird.
Obviously, we, from our standpoint, we can go and say, look, I didn't understand Wagner until I went to the Ring Cycle in Seattle over a summer. And then I said, oh, now I get it.
And by the way, fuss is all about.
Yeah. And by the way, you can't do it on record. You can't do it on CD. You have to go there. And again, I'm going to use a religious term, witness this, to see what it's all about.
You have to have it rattle the bone, your
exactly,
bones, you know,
exactly. And see what the whole trajectory is. Now, I can't, why not do that? And then 2 days later, listen to Brahms first or Brahms fourth, right? Or the academic overture and say, man, this cat had something. You know, now he's different than Wagner. And by the way, I detest Wagner as a person. Okay, but he was a son of a bitch. Excuse me. I hope that's okay to say that on the show.
Sure, we've said worse.
Good. He just was. But then you say, just as you said before, yeah, music isn't created by somebody who's tall, green, purple, white, black, or what. It's created by a composer who expresses something. Mm-hmm. And Wagner had it. Yeah, I mean, he did something, and so does Brahms. So we, and who come a little later, we're not involved in the interscene warfare as you are in a contemporary position.
Right.
And we can step back and say, wow, both of these guys really had something rich and deep to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Jay Nordlinger, hosting Q&A, which is produced by Madeline Osborne. The sponsors of this episode are Tommy John and X-Chair. Thank you so much. He is Daniel Asia of the University of Arizona and the American Culture and Ideas Initiative. His book is Observations on Music, Culture, and Politics. Dan, I'm glad you exist. It's very important that you exist. And as we said in the 70s, I think, keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much, Jay. It's been a pleasure, as always, speaking with you.
Until next time, everyone, so long.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.